Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Carl from ISF and Deviant Legion, and glad you could join us tonight. We have a very, very special guest who I will introduce here in a moment. But first, I'd like to introduce my guest panelist. First off, one of our regulars at this point from Oklahoma City, Patrick Crane. Say hello, Patrick.
Hello, everybody.
And I'm very, very pleased to have on with us tonight someone who, without him, I would not be doing what I'm doing. And that would be my former partner and good friend and basically brother in arms. That would be Stephen Ronquillo. Stephen, really glad to have you on tonight.
Hey, Darren, everybody got bad. I'm so glad to be on your show. I mean, good God.
All righty then. So now at this point, I'm very pleased to have back on the show a good friend and a very talented man, and someone who just had a movie that he restored premiere at the Metrograph here in New York City, and that would be John Alan Simon. John, welcome to the show. Really glad to have you again.
Thank you, Carol. Nice to hear from you again. Always glad to talk with you.
Well, I really appreciate it. So tell us a little bit about Out of the Blue and how you came into wanting to restore it and get it back out there to the general public. And tell us a little bit about the film.
Well, Out of the Blue was the third directorial effort of Dennis Hopper. His first directorial film, his debut, was Easy Rider. And probably there's never been so auspicious a debut film by a director as that. It premiered at Cannes, and it changed the movie business, and it changed the American culture of the 60s. Because of its huge success, the doors of Hollywood opened up to young bearded guys to make movies that they wanted young audiences to see. The studios had floundered a few years earlier with big musicals like Paint Your Wagon and Julie Andrews and Star, and they were at a loss for what to do. And then Dennis Hopper made this little motorcycle odyssey movie for very little money, and it was one of the top grossing films of the year and really changed the way Hollywood did business. But for Dennis, what it meant was that his second film, a movie prophetically called The Last Movie, was financed by Universal. Dennis was given complete and full artistic control, and the film he made was hated by Universal. Absolutely loathed. They felt that he had taken a script that had some narrative and he had totally deconstructed it. He'd made a movie in the spirit of European filmmakers like Godard and Antonioni. And although the movie premiered at the Venice Film Festival, where it won the Critics Prize, it was basically shelved by Universal. And this is not supposition. I know firsthand how much they hated the movie, because 10 years later, when Dennis had never gotten the chance to direct a third film, and we were distributing Out of the Blue originally back in 1982, I had a writing and producing deal at Universal. I was sitting with the head of the studio over breakfast, a very nice man who was really very encouraging and a mentor to me. And I said to him, we're distributing this little Dennis Hopper indie Out of the Blue, and it's getting great reviews and doing really well. And Dennis and I are talking about a few books we like in common and projects we'd like to develop. And this stricken look came over the face of the head of the studio, put his cup of coffee down, and looked me in the eye and said, John, if you ever say the words Dennis Hopper in my presence again, you will never step foot on the lot at Universal. And I kept waiting for the smile and the little laugh that never came. And what I learned later was that this studio executive had been Dennis's executive on the last movie, as chronicled in an amazing documentary by Lauren Schiller called American Dreamer, which shows Dennis kind of completely off the rails in terms of the post-production process of the movie, orgies and drug use and gun-toting. It's quite a hoot, although I think in fairness to Dennis, he was playing a part of himself in it. In any case, both his directing career completely halted and his acting career faltered. And I had taken out a little movie called The Wicker Man back when I was a film critic in New Orleans and had kind of a nice success with it. And in fact, Time Magazine did a full-page article on me in their show business section on how I was the guy rescuing these lost movies. So I was deluged with dozens and dozens of unloved and unseen movies, most of which deserved their fate, I must say. But one of which was Out of the Blue. And I still remember watching it in a little screening room back, I guess, in 1982 in Hollywood at Highland. And I just fell out of my seat. This was a movie that spoke so directly to my sensibility. It was very bleak, very nihilistic, beautifully made, beautifully acted, kind of a tone poem of alienation with Linda Mann, the little girl from Days of Heaven, who was so riveting in that movie, who narrated it, starring in the movie, giving a ferocious portrayal of a young girl whose family is completely dysfunctional and who's trying to find family and affiliation in the punk rock movement. So Dennis and I took it on the road. And I'll let you ask another question so I don't just ramble on and on.
Okay. Well, let me say something real quick. I have, you asked something out about the last movie, and I always use this as a term. Friends, don't let Joe Dworsky edit your movie. That's how you get the last movie.
Well, Jodorowsky, my understanding is Jodorowsky's cut doesn't exist. The movie that is on Blu-ray and played some theaters a few years ago after the movie was kind of finally unveiled again for the second time with a lot more appreciation, that's Dennis's cut. Jodorowsky, I think, has spoken about doing a cut that was more linear and kind of more comprehensible for American audiences. But the fact of the matter is that the screenplay was written by Stuart Stern, who wrote Rebel Without a Cause, which was one of Dennis's first early performances as an actor, with the guy who became really his mentor and best friend, James Dean. They went on to do Giant together, and James Dean just had a tremendous influence on Dennis. I think right up until the day Dennis died, he still thought of James Dean. And we talked about him when we were on the road with Out of the Blue back in 1982 many, many times, and what he'd learned about acting from James Dean. But last movie, it's funny, you know, when we were on the road with Out of the Blue, Dennis kept telling me, oh, man, you got to do something with the last movie, you know. People got to see it. And I said, okay, you know, I'll try. And I got a couple of play dates for it, and nobody came. Nobody reviewed it. And I couldn't get any more. And it was kind of unfortunate. I liked the movie, but I had a running conversation with Dennis about the fact that I thought Out of the Blue was a much better film in many ways. And by the end of his life, Dennis was saying Out of the Blue may be my best film, and I think it was, and a lot of people do, although I must say that the last movie has its fans, and I'm one of them.
Yeah. So, Patrick, do you have a question for John?
Well, I was just, you know, initially just first curious, I was going to ask about The Wicker Man, because I'm sort of at a disadvantage. Out of the Blue has been one of those movies that has been relatively, it's not inaccessible, but I have not been able to come by it easy. I know that there was an Anchor Bay DVD of it, and I've long awaited the Blu-ray release, and now I'm very excited. I had pre-ordered the copy out of the UK, so that's on its way. But my question was going back to The Wicker Man and what drew you to that project.
Well, what drew me to The Wicker Man, I was a film critic and staff writer for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. I'd written about films when I was an editor on the Harvard Crimson. And when I was in grad school in Chicago, I kind of had a syndicated column in kind of underground papers, alternate papers. They weren't really underground in Chicago. And when Roger Ebert would go on vacation, he had me fill in for him occasionally. And I think Ebert was kind of grooming me a little bit to take over at the Chicago Sun-Times. And then he won the Pulitzer and they quadrupled his salary and he decided to stay. And he did for the rest of his life. But he kind of recommended me to the New Orleans paper. And I went down there. And of course, The Wicker Man is a long, long story in and of itself. But when I was down there, I met a guy named Sterling Smith, who had a TV show on the UHF channel, which meant that it was virtually unseen by human beings. But he kind of played this very pompous older gentleman in a powdered blue tuxedo and ruffled shirt, talking about movies with a pipe, which obviously wasn't lit and didn't have tobacco in it. And he would interview guests who came into town with movies on the, you know, from the studios. And everyone I knew just thought he was a total buffoon and a total idiot. And one night, I'm sitting in the newsroom. I was Night City editor that night. It was about midnight. And a call comes in, and lo and behold, it's Sterling Smith. He had been at the Sanger Movie Theater in downtown New Orleans, which was a grindhouse, basically, where they played Italian horror movies and blaxploitation films. And he had reached into his box of popcorn and been bitten by a rat. And I wrote a story about it, and it helped him sue the theater chain and make a few bucks for himself, I'm happy to say. But we became friends until the end of his life. And what I discovered was that he was about 20 years younger than he appeared on TV, and that he was this very vigorous, energetic, brilliant guy who had an encyclopedic knowledge of movies, including movies that were kind of unseen. He had two fairly disastrous ventures in the movie business in New Orleans. One was making a movie called Mary Ann, which was directed by Noel Black, who had done Pretty Poison, and starring Kitty Wynn, who had co-starred with Al Pacino in Needle in the Park. And that movie had been unfinished and unreleased and besetted by lawsuits from investors. The other experience was he picked up a kind of a quaint horror film, horror may be too strong a word for it, called Nothing But the Night with Peter Cushing. And that likewise had gotten beset by investor lawsuits. So that might have been a warning. But in any case, we started talking about all these lost movies. And he happened to go on a junket to Hollywood. And I said, look, you know, this Wicker Man thing sounds very interesting. See if you can get Warner Brothers, who had acquired it and had it recut, basically, by Roger Corman. They were using the Corman cut and had shelved the movie after a test drive-in in Atlanta. I said, have them send it to us. Let's see if we can do something with it. I saw it, and I liked it. And Sterling convinced me we could do something with it. And then later I saw the print of the movie, the one print that existed of the director's cut, Robin Hardy's cut, and met Robin Hardy. And I liked the movie much, much better. I really saw what the intention was with it and how brilliantly Robin had put Anthony Schaefer's screenplay into film form. And so we had a huge success with it. It played the Orson Welles Cinema in Boston, in Cambridge for like 3 months. It played a lot of theaters for that kind of period. And unfortunately, what happened was that one of our partners kind of absconded with the one print, but I was able to kind of wrest control long enough of it to be able to do a video transfer. So we reconstructed the movie using dupe footage from the long print. And so it was a little bit unsatisfactory on 35 millimeter. But when we did the home video release, I was able to release Robin Hardy's cut of it. And then the 35 millimeter print, which we didn't own and I didn't control, kind of disappeared back into the recess of history. However, I did still have the video transfer, and Anchor Bay, when they put out their wooden box edition of The Wicker Man, I let them use it to do that version in that release and talked about it in the making of and distributing of disc that they put out. So that's kind of the Wicker Man story in a nutshell.
If you want to see that interview that he's talking about with the New Orleans guy, it is on pretty much every DVD and Blu-ray release of The Wicker Man. The interview with you, Christopher Lee, and the guy you were talking about with the pie.
Oh, I didn't know they had footage of Sterling. He died. It was very funny. He dropped dead very suddenly right after. I hadn't seen him for a couple of years, and I ran into him in a party here in L.A., and the next day he was dead. So I didn't know he was. I guess I should look at my copy. I never like to look at myself. So there you go. So out of the blue, what I did with The Wicker Man was take Christopher Lee kind of from town to town. And because I was a former film critic and had good relationships with film writers and critics, they wouldn't write a good review for me, but they'd tell me if they liked the movie. So for example, I knew that the critic in Boston really loved the movie, and I knew Roger Ebert was not a fan really of The Wicker Man. So we kind of skipped Chicago and we played San Francisco at the Lumiere there, where it played again for like 3 months, and played in LA, and it did really, really well, and kind of pioneered by accident a kind of handheld distribution. So when I saw The Wicker Man, what I discovered was that Dennis had been initially hired just to act, to play the father in what was a movie called CB for the name of the main character. Her name was Cindy Barnes, and she was into kind of ham radio, citizen band radio, and she was in love with Elvis, and she was kind of a burgeoning juvenile delinquent. And Raymond Burr, in the original script, was a friendly shrink who was going to help save her and the family, and it had kind of an upbeat, optimistic ending. But what happened was that the director, original director, writer, producer, shot for a week, and the producers who were kind of in charge didn't like the footage, didn't think he was getting the performance out of Linda that he might have. Dennis hadn't worked at all, hadn't been in any scenes, and they were shutting down the production. And Dennis said, well, let me look at what he's got. Maybe it's better than you think. And Dennis didn't like it any better than they did. But he said, look, if you give me full artistic control, I'm going to rewrite the script and I'll start shooting Monday. This was a Friday. So he was driving around, heard his friend Neil Young's song, My, My, Hey, Hey, Out of the Blue and Into the Black on the radio. And the lyrics are, the king is gone but not forgotten. That's Elvis. This is the story of Johnny Rotten. And Dennis was a tremendous student of contemporary culture. And he was very interested in what was going on in kind of the beginning days of punk. And he decided to bring in this whole punk rock element to the movie, which is quite essential to it, if you see the movie. And he shot the movie in 4 weeks, starting from scratch, edited the movie in 6 weeks, and it was accepted as an official selection at the Cannes Film Festival, which for all you filmmakers out there know, it's kind of the Grand Slam home run of getting into festivals. However, by letting Dennis direct the movie, what happened was that the movie no longer qualified to be a Canadian film. Now, who cares, right? However, the reason you care is that under the Canadian tax code at the time, investors in Canadian movies that qualified as Canadian by content and cast, there was a point system, investors could write off wealthy dentists and doctors and business guys. If they invested $10,000 in the movie dollars, they could write off $40,000, $50,000, $60,000. So they were in profit even if the movie never made a penny before anything ever happened. But by virtue of Dennis coming on board, it lost its certification. All the investors went from a guaranteed profit on paper to a guaranteed total loss. And the producers and the filmmakers and financiers were at war with each other. So having seen the movie and having fallen in love with it, I contacted Dennis and said, hey, if you'll do what I did with Christopher Lee, go around the country with me, opening town by town, kind of barnstorming for publicity, getting on every radio show and news show and TV show and newspaper interview. You know, this could be fun. I love the movie. And he said he would. And his career was kind of stalled in many ways. And I think it kind of invigorated him that somebody after 2 years of the movie sitting on the shelf kind of wanted to do something with it. And he used to, you know, one of the things he would tell me is, hey, man, Jack and Warren love my movie, love this movie. And I kind of got sick of him saying it all the time. And I kind of exasperated said to him, well, how is that going to help us? Are they willing to help us? Nicholson and Beatty, you know, who were huge stars at the time. And he said, oh, man, you don't understand. Jack has this little notebook, and he has the name of every one of his friends in it. And if you ask him for a favor, he opens it up right in front of you and opens it to the page where your name is written. And he takes out a pen and crosses your name out right in front of you and does you the favor. And I said, well, time to get your name crossed out. So we flew up to Aspen and spent the weekend. And I interviewed Nick Nicholson and recorded conversation with him and edited into this amazing radio spot where Nicholson says, I've never endorsed anything, not even of my own, but if a masterpiece comes along, people should see it. You know, this movie has everything you want to see. And for people who love movies, this is a movie they've got to see. And that really, really helped the movie and get it attention. And so that's kind of how it happened. And then, hello?
Yes, I have two questions. One, is this the infamous tour for Out of the Blue where Dennis Hopper blew himself up?
Well, that came a little later. The movie had already opened New York and Los Angeles and Boston and some other markets. But unfortunately, what was then and still is a major art house theater circuit, Landmark Theaters, hated the movie with a passion. They just hated it. They thought it was so bleak and nihilistic and dark and disturbing. They wouldn't play it in any of their theaters. They had about 20 theaters. So the movie was booked into the Walker, booked into Rice University. I guess that's the, I think it's called the Walker Center down there. I could be wrong. And Dennis wanted to borrow the print to take it down there and because they were doing a retrospective of Dennis's work. And I said, sure. And I was going to come, but I had something else going on. So he went down there, and by that time he was kind of off the wagon again. I had told him, he kept asking me if I would open New York with the movie. And I said, look, you know, if you're sober, I will, but it's expensive. You never make any money in New York. But yeah, I'll get you on the Letterman show. And so he kind of cleaned up for a period of time. But by the time of the infamous dynamite chair incident, where he was duplicating this famous Russian stunt of planting dynamite all around a chair where a guy sits, and the guy survives it because the force kind of, I guess, nullifies itself, imploding in, that it goes out, that, you know, that was right before he actually went into deep rehab and came out kind of a changed guy. But what I'd like to say about Dennis, one of the reasons that we did this 4K restoration is that about 12 years ago, the Cinémathèque Française wanted to do a major retrospective of Dennis as a photographer and artist and filmmaker, and they offered to help restore the negative in order to create two new 35mm prints. And another organization, the Thompson Foundation, came on board, and I supervised that 35mm restoration. And Dennis had really always trusted me on these things, and I offered, you know, to have him come in and look at the print and help tweak things. And he said, no, you know, man, you know, you do it. So he had a lot of confidence in me. And one of the things I didn't mention was that while we were on the road, we became really good friends. And in fact, I discovered a tape of a conversation we had that I'd done 40 years ago and never listened to, where I was going to interview him just to have my own interview of him. And it just became two guys talking. He started doing funny voices and kind of kidding around, and it just became two guys talking about movies and books and music and women and life. And it really reminded me how much fun it was to be in Dennis Hopper's company. But the reason we did the restoration, my wife, Elizabeth Carr, who I kind of shanghaied to help me produce it and help do the fundraising when we couldn't get any foundations to help, is what a great mentor Dennis was. Radio Free Albemuth, which I know you're a fan of, Carl, would never have happened.
Absolutely.
If not for Dennis Hopper. And I would never have met Elizabeth, my wife and producing partner, if not for Dennis, because he kept saying, you should be a filmmaker. You should make films. You should direct. I said, well, I'm a writer. I feel pretty good about myself as a writer, and I think I understand editing well enough to work with a good editor, and I'm, you know, I know a lot about music, even though I'm not a musician, but I know damn all about acting. He said, I'll teach you. And on the road, it was like a master class in acting. He would really take me through how to get performance and what an actor's process is. And it was an amazing experience to learn from Dennis that way. So the two prints that we struck for the 2010 restoration, even though we were very careful and only playing them at museums and archives and top-notch movie houses like Anthology Film Archives and the Brooklyn Academy of Music, they were starting to get worn and damaged. And as most of you know, Technicolor isn't in the film business anymore. Film really in many ways doesn't exist anymore. And so we did a 4K restoration from the original negative at a place called Roundabout Entertainment, where I was led to by a friend of mine who's always been a great technical advisor to me, Robert Harris, who's probably the world's foremost restoration expert. He restored Napoleon and Lawrence of Arabia and Bridge on the River Kwai and My Fair Lady and Spartacus and The Godfather. And in point of fact, Roundabout, which is where he brought me in and told them to work with me, and, you know, that we didn't really have much money, and this was going to be kind of a labor of love. They were working on Apocalypse Now at the time in 2019, and we would kind of sneak in when they weren't busy. So we had that old adage of the indie film business, good, fast, cheap, pick two. Because if it's good and fast, it won't be cheap. Cheap and fast, it won't be good. So if you want it to be good and cheap, it won't be fast. So it wasn't fast, but I'm very proud. We were selected by the Classics Division of the Venice Film Festival to premiere in September 2019 as an official selection. And in doing the Kickstarter, what I love about crowdfunding for all of you indie filmmakers out there, first of all, the money is really, you know, money's great. Let's not kid ourselves. But the money is not really the object, principal object of the exercise. The object is to find community. And we did that for the distribution of Radio Free Albemuth. And we did it again for the restoration and re-release of Out of the Blue. Elizabeth, who's a social media whiz, spearheaded it and to cover part of the cost. And in doing it, we found out that Chloe 70 and Natasha Lyonne were major fans. They came on board to help support it outside the Kickstarter and came on board as presenters. So when we premiered Wednesday night at Metrograph in New York, Natasha Lyonne showed up for the Q&A, and the artist filmmaker Julian Schnabel, who had been a lifelong friend of Dennis Hopper. And when we premiered in Venice, we were really lucky. Chloe 70 was doing a series for HBO and shooting about 30 minutes outside Venice. So she was able to show up and be on the red carpet and help us introduce the movie in Venice. So it's really been the kind of labor of love. I like to say that Out of the Blue is like the Velvet Underground. We're now getting re-exposed again, too, that maybe only 1,000 people bought their album, but half of them became rock critics or musicians. So they had this enormous influence beyond the reach of their commercial audience.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I can remember when the Anchor Bay DVD of Out of the Blue come out. It's like what I call a 30-second DVD because I think it was in print in discount brands and then just out of print within 2 months.
Well, it got pirated a lot, unfortunately. I kind of had wanted to wrest it from the Anchor Bay release. And it got pirated when a company called Media Home Entertainment went out of business. They had some masters, and they weren't very good, and people found it and cut off the copyright notice and because they thought it was under – they didn't realize that it was a Canadian movie. And so, you know, they bootlegged an enormous number of bootlegs, and you couldn't find the companies to sue them. They were like they were like ghost companies, but eventually we kind of got that under control.
Now, one thing I wanted
I heard,
to say very quickly.
Wait,
hold,
let me
hold
ask
on.
One last question, Carl, please.
Okay, go for it.
And I heard that Raymond Burr was a little bit difficult on the set because he didn't like the script changes that took him from being like the hero and the savior of the movie and to what the movie is now.
Well, you know, I've done – one of the things I've done, as you were asking me about the BFI disc, which is coming out shortly, I did about – I think I did about 20 interviews for it with all the surviving cast and crew. And they're including, for the first time, although this will be on the Severin disc, not on the BFI disc, an interview with Leonard Yakir, who was the writer-producer, who was fired as the director the first time he's ever – spoken on the record, to the best of my knowledge, about his experience on Out of the Blue. And Raymond Burr, according to Dennis, there were a lot more scenes with Raymond Burr. And Burr wanted to work on his own scenes and rewrite them. And Dennis decided the easiest thing to do would be to shoot all the Raymond Burr scenes, even though he intended to only use two of them. And evidently, that's what's happened. the outtakes, unfortunately, don't survive from the movie. So Dennis was a great storyteller, and, you know, you can't necessarily believe as factual truth every Dennis Hopper story, let me put it that way. But they're all very entertaining. They were all very entertaining and very unusual. According to Leonard Yakir, nobody has a copy of the original script that we can locate, CB. And I guess Dennis's script was mainly in his head, because every morning the actors would meet in his trailer and basically improv the day's work before they went out and actually shot it. It's what Dennis would call set improvisation, meaning that you would improv and then set the dialogue and do it when the cameras were rolling. You would find the scene, the heart of the scene, in those improvisations, but then not deviate from the dialogue when you actually shot it. So Raymond Burr, I do know from Sharon Farrell, who's the last surviving major cast member. I spoke to her not long ago for the one of the disc extras that will be on both the BFI and the Severn discs, Blu-ray discs. She said that Dennis and Raymond Burr were really two different schools of acting, and Dennis told him, she said Raymond Burr would come on set all dolled up in makeup, and Dennis would say, "Get that crap off your face. I'm not shooting you this way. This is, you know, this isn't a Hollywood movie. This is art. I want you to look like a real person." And Raymond Burr is quite good at it in those two scenes. And it really works in a curious way because it so represents a point of view that is outmoded, this idea of kind of the liberal do-gooder at a point when the idealism of the 60s has really and 70s has really given way to a kind of a miasma of self-indulgence and decadence. And I think vacuousness in the 80s. I mean, the opening lines are Linda Manns, who we haven't talked about yet, saying, "Disco sucks, kill all hippies." And this is a movie from the guy who really, in a curious way, solidified the invention of what it was to be a hippie with Easy Rider, Dennis Hopper. And it's a kind of a commentary on Easy Rider. In Europe, some places called it Son of Easy Rider or Daughter of Easy Rider, because it's kind of an evolution of that generation's point of view, how that idealism, you know, didn't work out so well.
Right.
And get the UK disc, you get two stickers with it, and it says, what he just said, Linda Mann's first line, "Kill all hippies."
Yep. So John, and, I wanted to interject here because you're right. We have not talked about Dennis's acting or Linda Mann's. Now, Linda Mann's is someone that, unless you know the Malick film and unless you know Days of Heaven and this film, she really disappeared in a lot of ways, and yet in this particular film she is a dynamo. I mean, she hooks up with Hopper and there's scenes between the two of them where she just matches them toe to toe. It is unbelievable to see her in this, and I want you to talk a little bit about Linda and then Dennis's work in the film.
Well, I got to know Linda when we originally released the movie back in 1982. She had had a really difficult childhood, and she was this curious combination of tender and vulnerable. And I think of Out of the Blue, for me, it's very reminiscent in certain ways of Truffaut's 400 Blows as a portrait of adolescent alienation. And like the character Jean-Pierre Luaud in that movie, the boy that he plays, Linda Manda's performance really goes the gamut from heartbreaking to furious, from cynical to, you know, she's clutching a teddy bear and sucking her thumb, even though, you know, she's 15 years old, although in reality she was 18 years old. And everybody who knew Linda, including me, was really struck by her, this innate kind of innocence and childlike quality and enthusiasm that she had. And when we restored the movie in 2010, she came, I played at a theater in L.A. called Cine Family, which is a really great theater, no longer in existence, sadly. And she came in, and I did a Q&A with her, and she was so happy that people were rediscovering the movie. And I think for her, she had done a couple of movies. She'd done Days of Heaven, in which it really wasn't a big part. But what was remarkable was that Terrence Malick, kind of in the post-production process, realized he needed something for the movie to cohere, and he came up with the brilliant idea of her character narrating the movie. She plays Richard Gere's sister in it, and a little sister. And she really improvised the whole narration, according to Malick. And it's just brilliant. It's so poetic and kind of cynical and childlike and all those things at the same time. And that's kind of who Linda was. And I think Dennis called her his co-director on Out of the Blue. And I think one of the reasons he was so keen to take over directing it was that he saw the potential. You have to give Leonard Yakir enormous credit for casting both Dennis and Linda Manns as what I think is maybe one of the most, if not the most, inspired father-daughter pairings of all time in cinema. There's this great scene when the mother, Sharon Farrell, who also gives an astonishing, brave, vulnerable performance in it, when she's talking to her daughter, and her daughter said, the father's been in prison, and she says to her, "Who do I look more like, you or dad?" And she says, "You know, like your dad." And the daughter obviously doesn't want to look like her father. She'd rather look like her really traditionally pretty blonde mother. And she kind of covers that by laughing and going, "Oh, girl Don." That's her father's name. And Sharon Farrell says, no, that's not it. It's like you've got the same attitude. Sums it up perfectly. They both had the same attitude in different generations in a different way that proves totally combustible in the movie. And the scenes between them when he comes back from prison are so tender and so full of yearning and longing for connection that it's really, it's very touching and always moves me when I see it, and I think moves most audiences. But then there are these secrets and these dynamics of the family that are gradually revealed that I think lead to a kind of harrowing conclusion of the movie that that I think is Out of the Blue, and I think still has the power to shock audiences 40 years later. And it did tremendously at the Metrograph this last Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. A lot of the screenings sold out, which is amazing during the time of COVID. And we're very pleased by the audience response in New York so far. And we're talking about now opening it in other cities like Chicago and L.A. and Austin, Texas, and Atlanta. We have some offers and are in discussions in all those cities.
It's a wonderful thing. I should tell you a little bit about my introduction to the film. So the film was shot in 1980, and I happened to see it on HBO. I think it was probably 81. Maybe 82, but before you got a hold of it and re-released it in Roadshow. But I remember seeing it late at night not knowing what it was, and just completely just destroyed me. I couldn't get to sleep that night. And I said, holy shit, a movie that did that to me. And by that time, I'm in my 20s. It's not like I'm a kid. And I just was just so astounded by the power that the film had and still does. You know, you talk about 40 years later, that ending is going to destroy almost anyone. And, of course, no spoilers here. You need to see the movie, folks, listeners.
Well, I've had a lot of people I recommend it to.
Mm-hmm.
They can't make it past the first 5 minutes. Because what happens there, that's what I call the point of no return. If you can make it through that, you're in for the long haul.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
So I think where you might have seen it, I'm certainly not aware of any HBO screening before we released it in theaters. Theaters wouldn't have played it if it had been on HBO. However, we did, you know, it was a long rollout in the theaters, and you might have seen it. My theory, I mean, I'll have to investigate it. Listen, I'm wrong plenty of times in my life, but I do know a lot about this movie. We did do a screening of it on Z Channel, which was a cable channel at the time, where they did a screening of Cimino's original cut of Heaven's Gate and a number of...
Yeah.
Pardon?
No,
of
I
Heaven's
made the mistake.
Gate and other movies.
Right. Well, I know this. HBO generally... particularly Canadian, and we were a test market, but at that point it was, you know, it was HBO.
Oh, you're talking about in Canada. You're talking about in Canada. In Canada.
Right, because we were close to Canada. I grew up in a
Canadian,
town called...
Canadian rights. Yeah.
Now,
sorry about that.
So
Canadian rights were different.
That was the case. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It may have been called, it had another title in Canada. And you may well have seen it. No Looking Back, it was called. And so you may very well have seen it on Canadian HBO.
Through the Hamilton channel or something like that. But, yeah, we definitely had Canadian channels that we could get. So maybe that was the case.
There you go. We're both right.
Okay. So anyway, the whole thing about it, For me, is that it's just so good to see a film like this and have somebody behind it to reintroduce it to a whole new audience. And you've done that several times in your lifetime, you know, with The Wicker Man and several other films. And I got to applaud you, John, seriously, for doing this for Out of the Blue.
Well, thank you. Like I said, it was kind of a debt of gratitude to Dennis. And what's been so amazing about it is that I kind of consider this like a touchstone movie. You know, a lot of people like The Wicker Man, and I don't like them necessarily. They're not my tribe. But anyone who likes Out of the Blue is sort of my family. And you know, when we were going to premiere, let me tell you a little more about Linda. So when we did this Kickstarter, that Elizabeth Carr is really responsible for, and really bringing in Chloe Sevigny and Natasha Lyonne, Elizabeth was riding in her car and heard Natasha on Fresh Air on NPR talking about Russian Doll, her series. And all of a sudden, she's talking about Dennis Hopper and Out of the Blue, and Linda Manns is amazing performance in it. And we happened to be invited to a Netflix event and ran into her and told her what we were doing. And that's how, and she offered her help. And that's how she came on board to support the restoration. But after Venice, I reached out to Linda to let her know what we were doing. And we had been chosen as an official selection for the U.S. premiere at South by Southwest, which is really prestigious. And Linda said, I'd love to go. I said, well, you know, let's We'll drive out to Palmdale, this very blue-collar suburb where she was working, to talk to her. What had happened to Linda after Out of the Blue? Well, she'd done Days of Heaven, and she did Out of the Blue, and she did Philip Kaufman's The Wanderers, and she did a little movie called Boardwalk. And those were all kind of real movies. And then she kind of retired from the movie business, not necessarily on purpose, but she was such a unique personality that she couldn't just go up for an audition for parts that other actresses her age were auditioning for, that were written for a 20-year-old, you know, young woman. She wasn't a typical 20-year-old young woman by any stretch of the imagination. She was something unique. She was like, as like Humphrey Bogart is to leading men, she was kind of like to leading young women, I think, kind of her own type, you know? A bogey movie is a bogey movie for the most part. And she got married and devoted herself to raising a family. Her husband was a cameraman who, in fact, was a camera operator on a movie I was one of the producers on called Howling Part 2. And although I'd never actually watched the movie, to be honest with you, the whole of the movie, it was directed by my friend Philippe Marat.
Yeah, we've had Philippe on several times. We love that man. Absolutely love him.
Well, there you go. We love Philippe. I love Philippe too. I'm not sure if I love Howling Part 2. It's pretty out there. But in any case, she had three boys, and her husband, about a year before the pandemic, or 2 years before, it had a very devastating stroke, and she was his caretaker, and he was on a hospital bed in the living room. And just earlier, about a year ago, one of her sons had died in a motorcycle accident, leaving her grandchildren without a father. And she was having a biopsy the next day that we went up there and took her to lunch and spent time with her. And it was really clear. In fact, I remember the conversation. I said, well, you know, we'll book plane reservations. And she said, well, I don't fly. I can't fly. And I haven't flown since I went to Cannes in 1980. And I said, well, really? Well, I guess, you know, it's about, if I drive 80 miles an hour, you know, which I like to drive, it's a cool trip from LA to Austin. And I guess we could make it in, 18 or 20 hours spending the night somewhere. And she said, well, you can't take highways. I'm afraid of highways. And, then I'm thinking, well, this would be like a week on the road going back and forth. And she said, yeah, and I don't go out much. Some days I don't go out at all. It's really hard for me to even go to the mailbox. She really was kind of suffering from agoraphobia. And then South by Southwest got canceled. They were kind of the first major event to cancel because of the pandemic. And we went into lockdown, and I texted her, you know, how did the biopsy go? I hope everything's all right. And, you know, she kind of changed the subject, and I kind of knew she was sick, and she passed away in August 2019, but she couldn't – 2020, sorry. But she couldn't have been more enthusiastic about the movie's restoration. She had like a little area of her small house right next to the kitchen and the dining area. There was like a shrine Out of the Blue with a poster up and pictures of her and Dennis together. And she, her favorite experience in the movies. And she wanted to help. So I had found a box of posters from the original release. And she signed 80 of them. And she said, you know, if anyone, you know, wants to buy them, they're, you know, you can sell them and try to raise some money towards the restoration. And that's one of the things we did as part of the Kickstarter. And we still got them on some of them that were still paying bills on the restoration. If you go to outoftheblue.dennishopper.com, there's kind of all the perks of the Kickstarter and a link back to it if you want to see the whole story of the movie and learn even more than I've rambled on about. It's there, and people can help support the effort.
Did you ever see the VHS cover that media put out for the first release of Out of the Blue?
Yes, that's the deal I made. I made that deal on it and, supervised.
So you're the one who wrote that back that says a riveting family drama about a teenage girl trying to bring her family back together.
No, they wrote their own copy. I didn't have final cut over the box, and the copy. I think they were, but it actually sold really well in the U.S. It moved a lot of copies. And one of the things I've discovered, I was talking about the tribe of people, was some of the people that I interviewed for the Blu-ray for BFI and for Severin are people like Ethan Hawke, who knew Dennis and are tremendous fans of the movie. He thinks it's a masterpiece. And Julian Schnabel, who I mentioned, who consider it a masterpiece. And he also thinks Last Movie is a masterpiece. He and Dennis were very, very close friends. And I interviewed Alex Cox and Philippe Marat. And there'll be even more interviews on the Severn disc because I had more time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I want to go into just a couple of other things very briefly as we wind up here. One thing is that I have a review of the showing at the Metrograph, okay, which just happened this past week, from Melissa Anderson. And I would suggest everyone who has an interest in this film to really read the article, which is just a wonderful review. And it gives some stills of it. And it talks about the work between Hopper and Linda Manns. But, man, I'll tell you something. As I have seen this film now, I think about three times, it is one of the bleakest films I've ever seen, and yet in many ways it's very human. And I just think it's a great film, and I'm so glad that you had something to do with it. And to bring it back.
Can I say one more thing about the restoration? Like a lot of like a lot of cinephiles, I'm kind of a 35mm snob, but as the technology has gotten better and better for digital, it's a little hard as a filmmaker to want to do that. I mean, people like David Fincher don't shoot 35mm anymore, though people like Chris Nolan do. But one of the things about Out of the Blue is, because it was really a low-budget film and shot quickly, some of the scenes are not properly lit. I know it bothered Dennis, but there wasn't much he could do about it. There's a scene in the last reel where I would say I said to Dennis when I was watching it with him for the first time, it's like black. Why'd you cut to black? And he goes, oh, man, my cinematographer screwed me on that one. He told me we could see what was going on, and you can't see anything. And there was no real way to cut it. But now, in the digital restoration, I was able to bring out enough detail that you can see what's going on in the dark a little bit. You see bodies moving, and you get an idea of what's going on. And in Raymond Burr's office, for example, there's a huge plate glass window, and it's just kind of smoggy out of it. And now in the restoration, I was able to bring out this beautiful shot of the mountains in Vancouver that I know is why they chose the office as the location to shoot. I mean, why else would you except to be able to see the mountains? So I didn't brighten it up unduly. I picked a few places where I felt there was detail that Dennis, as a very skilled photographer, would have wanted to bring out if he could have, if there had been the budget and the technology to do it. And the movie is the framing of the 35mm movie even though I might have argued with Dennis about reframing a couple of things if he'd been around. But, you know, there was no way to reframe stuff back then. And, in fact, every time you showed a 35-millimeter film, because the film image was bigger than what you see on screen, it would be matted. And every theater would mat it, could mat it slightly differently. So that's why you see booms coming down in movies that were shot in film, because they're not properly matted by the projectionists, not because the filmmakers are idiots, although they might be idiots, but that's not evidence that they were idiots necessarily. But not in out of
well,
blue.
You can
no
tell
blue.
When they do it on purpose than a bad, and the difference between that and a bad match.
Right. So
yeah,
there you go. And now I'm going to get back to work on scripts and getting our films made. We're very close to announcing a project with a really great director from a novel by Lucia Shepherd called Green Eyes. And we'll be announcing that very shortly. We're in the final throes of the contracts with the company that's going to finance it.
Oh,
good. So what that was the next thing to give, just give you a little bit of time to promote websites and your films. And of course, I would say to anyone, this is the director of Radio Free Albemuth, one of my favorite science fiction films from Philip K. Dick. And you need to watch that particular film for sure. So what else do you want to promote before we leave you go?
Well, the mainly thing I want to promote is Out of the Blue, because most of the other things we're doing are kind of dependent on the gatekeepers giving us the go-ahead. But I am working on an adaptation of Philip K. Dick's Flow My Tears, the Policeman Said. It's been an endless development, but I'm working on a new draft, and we have interest from a new star and potentially from a new director, and that's not ready to announce yet. And also, we were developing for a while a Jim Thompson project called Pop 1280 that Yorgos Lanthimos was going to direct but dropped out. I mean, these are the vicissitudes of these big movies, and you know, we just keep working. I keep wanting to make the things I love. And remembering Dennis Hopper's words that, you know, you can sleep on a mattress on the floor, but you got to make the stuff you believe in. And that's what we try to do. And Out of the Blue is a movie I've believed in for 40 years. And it's so great that people from Richard Linklater to Scott Derrickson, who directed Doctor Strange, to David Robert Mitchell, who directed It Follows and Under the Silver Lake, are all huge fans of this movie. And, you know, we talk about it, and now I know them, and, you know, it's a good opportunity to introduce them to some of the other material I love and to see if we can make some films that challenge people that aren't just these comic book tentpole movies, which I have nothing against. I'm not Martin Scorsese or Christopher Nolan. I enjoy many of them. I love Thor Ragnarok, and I like the Avengers trilogy, but hey, kids, there's other things to movies than that.
Absolutely. John, as always, it is a true pleasure to have you on, and I really appreciate. So, Patrick, do you have any final...
One quick more thing. Can I say one more quick thing? You can reach out to us on Facebook. Reach out to us on Facebook. We answer people. Out of the Blue, Dennis Hopper on Facebook is a great place to message us. On Instagram, Elizabeth Carr is really handling that, and Twitter. We have a big presence there, too. And it's all on the Facebook page, which I do read and do respond to, and Elizabeth brings the other stuff to my attention.
Good. I'm glad you said that. So Patrick, any other questions for John before you go? You've been relatively quiet tonight.
Well, I've just been listening, and I thank you, John, for coming on and sharing all those stories about Dennis Hopper. He seems like he was a very important figure in your life, and really the stories were very moving. I was just kind of enraptured with all of that. And I sort of feel like I'm maybe the luckiest person on this podcast because I'm the only one that gets to see this movie for the first time yet. I'm getting ready to. And so I'm sort of excited to see this, and I'm really hyped for it. I've been wanting to see this for a long time. I'm a huge Linda Manns fan, and I'm a huge Dennis Hopper fan. So thank you for coming on, and I'm really looking forward to watching this enjoyed listening to you.
Where are you going to – what city are you in?
I'm in Oklahoma City. I ordered the –
Oklahoma City? You're probably going to have to see it on disc, I'm guessing.
Oh, yeah. No. I ordered the – I've already pre-ordered the UK disc. That's coming. I think it's being shipped very soon. So I'll be seeing it pretty soon.
Well, I've seen already received the UK disc, so it came out, I think, this week.
Did you get it from Amazon UK, or did you?
I don't know. I've just seen people's pictures of it up.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I got mine from Amazon UK, so it takes a bit. I'll be getting it, like I said, in a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can also wait for the Severin disc because it'll have some. They're not 100% identical, and there's some things on the BFI disc that won't be on the Severin disc, and there's some things on the Severin disc that won't be on the that aren't on the BFI disc. But I think the Severin disc, I think we're anticipating it'll be UHD, so it'll be maybe a better quality viewing experience. But they're both going to be great, and if you're real out of the blue fan, you'll collect both.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
I double dip all the time.
I would like to say on behalf of all the fans of The Wicker Man and Out of the Blue, thank you, thank you, thank you for all you do. And you may say to us Wicker Man fans, we're not your brew. Yes, you are, because we know from our hearts if it wasn't for you and people like you, we wouldn't get a chance to become a cult.
Well, that's right.
Absolutely.
I'm just saying that. No, I like all of them, and I'm glad they're grateful. But it's just that kind of thing. Like everyone who likes the Beatles isn't necessarily your kind of person, but everyone who likes Primal Scream, who did actually sample Out of the Blue for one of their songs called "Kill All Hippies," they probably are on your wavelength. Wicker Man, I love Wicker Man. Don't get me wrong, and I love the folks who love it, but Out of the Blue is like Velvet Underground to the Beatles. It's really
absolutely
a special experience. That is in a way defining of how you look at the world and what you want a movie to be. And Out of the Blue and Wicker Man are great movies. Don't get me wrong.
Well,
and the other movie that I really
said of Out of the Blue, so I'm a giddy about getting the Severin.
There you go.
All right, John. Well, so what we're going to do now is we're going to do what we call housekeeping and go through things. So, again, I just want to thank you very, very much for being on with us. You can stick around if you like. One thing I'm going to do right now is get it over to Stephen, because, Stephen, you need to do a little promotion on what you do and your network. So go right ahead, sir.
What I'm doing this week is my annual torture tradition, which I call Crap Giving. And I have made the stupid or smart decision, no stupid decision, to watch with Nate my co-host, Veronica. Oh, God.
Okay, I need to say something here, because I was the recipient of many of these really craptastic films. This man made me watch Gaudy and Surviving Christmas. So, yes, my heart goes out to you, Nate, seriously. Okay, so as far as what we're doing, tomorrow
Patrick is going to be joining us along with Brian Wallinger, and we're going to be doing our third episode in Noirvember, and we're going to be focusing specifically on foreign noirs. And so we've done also classic and then post-classic noirs. This will be our third episode. You can find all these episodes up on Deviant Legion and also on the ISF page, or you can find them on my page on Facebook. Really looking forward to tomorrow, Patrick. What have you thought about the series so far?
Oh, it's been great. Of course, yeah, I love noirs, so this has been a really, you know, fun month for me because this is the first month where I've really been able to kind of luxuriate on them, watch a lot of them from different periods, and I've just had a ball. And I'm still watching the foreign noirs. I'll probably be watching them all the way up to when we record tomorrow.
Hey, well, guys, I got to jump in and say I love noir. I'm working the next thing I direct, I hope, is going to be a noir based on a Jim Thompson novel called Nothing More Than Murder. So I'm glad I stayed on. I'm going to jump off, but I think I'll be listening to that one for sure. Are you going to have American Friend as one of them?
Oh, cool. Oh, yeah, I love Der Amerikaner zu Freund. Oh, with that, I'm a Fenders absolute freak. I love Ben Fenders. I love his work.
Well, that's one of Dennis's best performances, I think. Dennis Hopper again.
Absolutely. But you know what? I'll drop you links to all those and PMs. So
well,
I'll get you all those to listen to. All right.
Thank you for letting me rave on about our blue.
Anytime you've got something going on, just let us know. You're on. It's not a problem. You're in.
Will do. Thank you. Thank you for indulging my long-windedness.
Not a problem. All right.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. So just to finish up on
Wednesday. And I
want
to say this to Carl and them. I think it breaks my heart that some of our best noir writers, their first exposure on film was in Venice films and Italian films.
We'll be talking about that tomorrow. Because
yeah.
One of the movies
with Stray Dog and
That's going to be mentioned tomorrow, Stray Dog. Brian has that on his list. But on Wednesday, I want to finish up for Wednesday, which is the day before Thanksgiving. We're going to have Miss Vicky Love on. And she's going to have a list of movies, particularly science fiction movies, because Vicky loves sci-fi, and that she's thankful for. And I will also be on that show along with my co-host, Rachel. So we're coming up on Thanksgiving, and one of the things that we're really thankful for is our listeners, and we really want to appreciate all of you. And I'm very thankful for my guests tonight, for Patrick, as always. You're part of the family now, my friend.
Oh, thank you. Love being on. Love being on with Carl.
And Stephen, you are always my brother. Always. And you're always welcome. All right? And so anyway.
And for the record, the pre-order for Severance Out of the Blue is not up yet, but I say because it's coming out in January, it'll be up in December.
Right. I would think that's probably true.
They announced they're putting up an art classic, a Severance. They announced an art classic film. An art classic film about a group of students who go out in the woods to look up for a search of a myth. Yes, we're getting a HD Blu-ray of Night of the Demon.
Nice.
In case
all
you're
right,
wondering,
folks.
Patrick, that's the one where the guy pisses on Bigfoot and Bigfoot rips his willy off.
All right, folks, we're going to say goodnight. Again, thank you very much, Patrick and Stephen. And we'll see you tomorrow for Noirvember Part 3. All right, folks, say goodnight.
Good night.
Don't let the bedbugs bite. Good night.